Hello, and welcome back to the Culture Blast podcast. I'm your host, Farah Nayeri, and I'm absolutely delighted to be here with you for a relaunch of the podcast and for the start of our exciting 2024 season. For the relaunch of our podcast, we have a magnificent new logo designed by a very dear friend, Igor Jocic, the great creative director and brand consultant who tragically left us in May 2023. We are forever grateful to Igor for his limitless generosity and gift, and we are extremely proud to represent his talent with this beautiful new Culture Blast logo. As you know, Culture Blast is a series of in-depth interviews with major personalities from all cultural disciplines. My guests have included Emma Thompson, Nile Rodgers, Nan Golden, Elif Shafak, Wayne McGregor, Ai Weiwei, Charlotte Gainsbourg, Sonia Boyce, and Ruben Ostlund. For our relaunch episode, we have an extraordinary guest, the performance artist Marina Abramović, who is one of the few living artists to be a household name all over the world. It's not an exaggeration to say that Marina Abramović has taken London by storm with her career retrospective at the Royal Academy of Arts in London. It's the first time in 255 years that the Royal Academy has allowed a female artist to put on a solo exhibition in its main galleries. Even though Marina herself was not performing, her presence and her charisma were powerfully felt by audiences who viewed the exhibition in their tens of thousands. As the Guardian art critic Adrian Searle wrote in his review of the show, and I quote, "Since the early 1970s, Abramović has at times risked her health, her sanity, and even her life in what I can only think of as a series of self-imposed tests of human endurance and persistence. She has burned herself, cut herself, drugged herself, taken on tasks that have stretched her physical and psychological limits to a degree most of us would refuse. Abramović persists, and she has created a tremendous legacy," wrote Searle. "We are less an audience than witnesses to the best of her art. It isn't over yet." Marina Abramović, it's a great privilege to have you as a guest of Culture Blast. Thank you so very much for accepting my invitation.
I'm happy to be here.
And I'm happy to have you, Marina. Very, very happy. We are meeting at your temporary London home during the final weeks of your retrospective at the Royal Academy, which has taken London by storm, I have to say, even though you didn't perform in it. And before the show opened, I and maybe others worried that because you were absent, it might not be as exciting as we would have liked, and I was wrong, because your charisma, your personality are absolutely present in the exhibition, and it's a great success. My first question, Marina, is how do you feel about your ability to conquer the British public in just a few months, a short span of time, particularly the young British public? And I wondered, is it because there's this craving for humanity, for human connection, in an age where people are dominated by screens, by individualism?
The story is that it's really a mixture of everything. A preparation is very important to me. This is a combination of many different things. First of all, to prepare this exhibition took me 7 full years. In the beginning, the exhibition was supposed to open 2020, and then become COVID. And during the COVID, this kind of work was impossible because it's lots of live elements, live performances, and also we have to work with the public directly as much as possible. And COVID was full of restrictions. And then finally came the time that I can do it. I got terminal disease. I almost died from the
pulmonary embolism,
so I could take the literally boat to arrive here. So I arrived here, and I remember in the beginning of the show, I was actually arriving in the wheelchair, kind of driving around to put this huge show together with Andrea Terzia, which was a wonderful curator to collaborate. And finally came this opening day, and I remember so much the that incredible moment that I finally can walk the steps without wheelchair, without any kind of helps or sticks, just by myself. But I'm walking, not just this, you know, the staircase to Royal Academy, my own show, but I'm walking the staircase with 255 years, no woman been walking from that kind of show.
But you've also said that people are craving, and young people especially, are craving human contact in the art experience.
You know,
it?
If you think about structure of the museums today and an art institution, it's very 19th, 18th century structure. It's always you're going to see something you're not able to touch and you have to look at something. And I think the young audience is fed up with this. New structure of the museum is they want to be part of something. They want to interact. They want to really have their own personal experience and which my work provide them.
Absolutely. I think that's exactly the reason. So you were referring to the fact that you're the first woman in 255 years, shockingly, to get a solo show in the main Royal Academy galleries. I'm thinking, what does that say about the Western art establishment? And what does that say about you?
You know, the position of the woman has been complicated and difficult for centuries. But one thing that's so interesting to, they just discovered recently, the scientists, that actually cave paintings was mostly made by women. And mostly that they discovered that something like 80% was made by women and not by men, which men went outside to hunt and women, you know, stay with children and make art. That means that the history of art starts with women. And then, you know, in historically, you know, the women become helpers to the men, artists. They become artists on their own. They never had any of this recognition and any status for centuries. And then you come to the 20th century, 21st century, when you see Louise Bourgeois, you know, she only started a really serious career when she was 60, when actually husband died, children grown up, and she can dedicate all her time to work. But I really think that for that kind of position of the women, in especially last century, this century, it is also our fault. And why I think it's our fault? If you look just at the abstract painting in America from the 50s, the majority of the galleries are women, and majority of women galleries are showing only male work. And why? They could show their own sisters and to show the work they're equally great and talented, but it was not the case. So there was also the in many ways, you know, the woman wanted to have the happy marriage, they want to have children, they want to have the balance between husband and herself and to be artist. But we don't have that much energy in our body. The man is much easier to kind of cancel everything because women doing all the work for him and to concentrate and make art. But in my case, I never want to have children. I'm not marriage material. And even if I'm married, but very short. And all what I want to do is be an artist. And all what I've been doing is actually working like hell.
Absolutely, yes. And not as if we hadn't noticed. Which brings me to my next question.
I just want to say something in between. You know, to me, it's so injustice for the art, the female artist here in Britain, because the Royal Academy is British territory and is British, you know, the museum. Why like the Tracy Emin could not have the big show in the big gallery? I never understand this. You know, I almost feel injustice that I'm the first one. Okay, I'm older than her, but still, you know, I think she should be the first.
I mean, I'm with you. There is this kind of built-in misogyny because I don't see what else we could call it. I mean, I think it is sexism and misogyny which has prevailed for so long, since the beginning of art history, to be honest. You are the world's best-known performance artist by a very long shot, and I think you've played a major role in bringing performance art into the mainstream. I mean, there are even parodies of you, which is a kind of very sign that you have entered the mainstream in the movie by Paolo Sorrentino, La Grande Bellezza, Great Beauty. There's this figure, a female performance artist inspired by you who keeps ramming into walls and at this party in a villa in Rome. Anyway, so I just wondered how you've managed to bring yourself into the mainstream as a very famous figure who's recognized all around the world, and also how you managed to bring performance art into the mainstream.
You know, let's start with the question how to manage to bring performance art in mainstream. It's really interesting to see history. You know, in the early 70s, when the performance art started, you know, many artists been doing performance art internationally, but it's very tough and very difficult, and it's not easy to sell. And then in the end of 70s, there was a pressure of the galleries, pressure of the museums, that they start producing things. So the performance arts actually also is aging. They stop doing performance and they start doing objects, they start doing video installations, they start doing, you know, the paintings, and this art was abandoned. I never abandoned performance art. I think it's really important to do something long enough that people start believing that it's important. And I'm doing this 55 years, and they're probably only still, you know, in my age, living artists who are still doing it. Really, one of the important things for me is to put performance art in mainstream category. Because in the 80s and 90s, photography and video was still not mainstream. It became very soon mainstream, but performance never. So now, you know, especially after my work like in Museum of Modern Art in MoMA, Artists is Present, became really mainstream. So that's one reason. You know, just put enough energy and believe in what you're doing to get mainstream. Another thing was, I think about being so relevant is that I never repeat myself. I'm not interested to do one performance over and over again. If I do one thing, I move to the next one. I mean, if 10 years ago somebody told me I would do opera, I would say, you're crazy, I would never do opera. It's such old-fashioned, you know, medium. But then I say, that's interesting, let's do something new with opera. And now, with the success of opera, I could make operas for the rest of my life. I'm totally not interested. I'm already working on a new project. So the thing is that I'm not going for the something that is sellable and art as a commodity. I'm always doing for something that have content and profoundly interests me.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right that you never stopped doing it. I mean, there was never an interruption, and you didn't go into another medium, like do sculpture for a while or painting for a while. You were always doing performance.
But, you know, repetition is incredibly dangerous. If one artist is recognized by one certain style and the market is very successful, he will repeat this the rest of his life. And I'm totally not interested because my market is not any kind of market, because performance art is very hard, you know, to as a sellable material, because it's so immaterial. And so that's why I think that I always become relevant, because I'm always looking for the new things and new ideas.
Absolutely. But given all of that, considering that, you know, your success and your kind of almost, well, not almost, I think you have rock star status. I mean, people really recognize you. There are autograph seekers chasing you everywhere and selfie seekers. And, you know, you can't really show your face now easily anywhere. And I'm wondering whether in your case, maybe being a woman has been an advantage, I think, because I can't think of a male performance artist anywhere who has that kind of celebrity or recognition. And of course, you know, I'm thinking, okay, trying to analyze this, there's your personality and charisma, which is considerable, but your striking physique, your beauty as a woman, and then also the fact that you've literally risked your life for your art. On many occasions, you really came close to dying while performing. And do you think that, you know, these factors contributed? And how do you feel being a female performance artist? Do you think it is an advantage?
You know, I don't see so much the advantage or disadvantage. I just see, so for me, it's so important to be a real thing, that whatever I'm doing is real, and what I'm doing, I stand for, and I don't like compromises, and I don't like fake stuff. My work is deeply emotional, and people, when they see the work, they're deeply moved, and that, you know, I have so many, you know, young kids who come and say, oh, your work changed my life, but they really cry, they really hug me, I have this very physical, very emotional response of my public to me, daily, on the street. I mean, I even have the women who run with the babies in Italy, just to hold the baby is good luck. I mean, this is too much, you know, definitely. I think it's really because of emotional aspect. But then I also have lots of jealousy and lots of bad criticism, which is absolutely part. You know, they will just, even my generation, the worst. My generation will come, if my generation only come for the exhibition, they come to see how I look like, if I'm sick or going to die soon, and if my work is bad finally, you know, and I don't have this with young people. And then also I found so much jealousy with women, which is so to me, you know, unnecessary, because we need to stick together and we really need to actually unite our forces. They will never always find excuse how to diminish actually talent or the work. I'm fed up with this. I do whatever I want and I don't absolutely care about this because my work is enough to talk about.
Absolutely. Ever since Marcel Duchamp submitted a urinal to an art exhibition a century ago, it's become much more difficult to define what art is. You know, there is this assumption nowadays that anything is art as long as the artist said so. But as you've pointed out, it's not that simple. You say art must be disturbing. It must ask questions, predict the future. That if art is just political, it becomes like a newspaper. And I just wanted to ask you, what makes art different from a newspaper or from archive material, from archiving everyday life? What is it that makes art?
I always have this example when I say so many times, you know, to me, like how to deal with the difficult situations in our life which we live in. Like right now, I mean, we're in the mess. We have the Palestinian on one side, the Jewish community on the other. We have, you know, war with the Putin and Ukraine. We have a mess everywhere. And the earth is warming up. And, you know, so how you deal with this? And if you just react on the reality, I think that somehow you put your spirit down. I'm always looking how I can create something that lifts human spirit, that actually gives positivity and not just reflection of negativity, which we already know. And to me, the great, absolutely great, great example is Matisse. During the entire, you know, Second World War, only thing he was painting was flowers. And I never understood till it really hits me why he was doing that. This was really to lift human spirit. We need to see something positive. And the root of this problem is wonderful sentence of His Holiness Dalai Lama, who said, only when you learn to forgive, you can stop killing. Human beings, centuries, never learned to forgive. And we are still doing what we are doing, and we continue. There are different names for different people, different nations, different religions, but the result is always the same. Results is killing, violence, and really, really, really the terrible things happening to human beings. So to me, the only way that I can see this out is to invite a group of people, and whoever want to come, and stay there for 7 minutes, total silence, put the hands on the shoulders of the stranger and give unconditional love. That we have to learn to fall in love with our planet. We don't even love our planet. If we love, we will not do it what we are doing. We also learn to fall in love with other human beings. Unconditional love. This is the root of everything. This is the something that if we can do that, we can change ourselves. By changing ourselves, we can change the world. It's very simple.
Yeah, so I mean, art rises out of unconditional love, of love of the other. That's what art springs from, right?
It's one of the elements of art, not only. You know, as I always talk about layers of meaning of art, the more layers, the longer are the good art going to exist, because every society takes layer he needs. Sometimes it's spiritual, sometimes it's heroical, sometimes prediction of future, sometimes have to be disturbing. But, you know, sometimes you have to open eyes and ask the question. Is every layer brings something new, but have to be many layers. With many layers, good art can exist for a long time.
And then this question of what is performance art? I know it's a question that's been put to you many times, but given what you just said, given the times we live in, what is performance art today?
But you see, if we think about the hierarchy of art forms, I always feel if you kind of create in your mind invisible pyramid, for me the music is highest, is the most immaterial, then the performance, then anything else. This is a subjective idea of an artist. I mean, many artists will not agree with me, but this is my view. And which I like, what is important with performance is living form of art. And that's so special. And that living form of art it's everything. Because, you know, if you come to an exhibition and you see paintings on the wall, you come once to see the show, maybe you come one more time, but that's it. But if you see something long duration and something's happening 1 month in the gallery, you will come to see once and you come back and you come back and you want to see how what energetically is happening in the space, what art is doing. You create art community. Everything becomes so vital and so energized. And that kind of life, art is life. If you think it was performance art is different than theater, it's different than ballet, it's different than the music concert. Performance art is the construction, mental and physical, that artists made in the front of the public in exact time and space. And then he entered into that space, and then actually energy dialogue with the public and him happened. And then, you know, the public become the mirror. You're taking energy, the public giving back, and the public and the performer become unit. The performers don't exist with the public. And then performers, if it's highly emotional, can really change your life.
You often say, and I quote, the more shitty a childhood you have, the better an artist you become. And so I wanted to ask you whether you agree that all art is basically autobiographical.
But look at the history of art. I never see good biography, the happy biography of happy art. Honestly, I mean, show me one, I will be happy to read. But all this childhood and all this biography is all the sicknesses of trauma, melancholy, depression, name it, is all there. And this is our source of actually creating art. And because it's something that we have to go deep inside of self and create something which is transcendental that other people can react. Because we all the same human beings. We all have same problems. So you, by actually showing openly yours, you can connect with others. And happiness is a state nobody wants to change. And it's not productive because I'm happy, I'm fine. I don't need to make anything.
So, okay, so you bring me exactly to my next question. Your childhood years were somewhat complex. You had parents who were great war heroes, decorated, distinguished in post-war Yugoslavia, so you lived in a comfortable home in Belgrade with unlimited access to culture, to books, music, art, and you even had a room as a little girl where you were allowed to paint. And your partisan parents gave you this great sense that there were no limits, that there was a sense of fearlessness, of willpower, and of military discipline, which you learned as a little girl. But at the same time, you grew up in a household that was strict and controlling, where, as you've said yourself, there was no love. You don't remember your mother hugging or kissing you, and where you sometimes endured physical punishment, meaning slaps. And you often point out in a very kind of moving way that there are many Marinas, that there is the Marina whose parents were war heroes. There's the grown-up Marina with lots of spiritual wisdom, and the little girl Marina within you who feels unloved, vulnerable, unbelievably disappointed and sad. And I guess it's true of all human beings, you know, we are multiple. But as an artist, you've created performances that are punishing and self-punishing. And I wanted to ask you whether, you know, one can see a correlation between your childhood and the formative years and the kind of art that you've made.
It's so interesting how this looks from outside and connected to my childhood. But if I were thinking now backwards, if I like to change anything, I actually want to not change anything. I think I learned from being alone. I learned to actually be in control of my own life, to be rebellion and to really have the courage to kind of leave country and just to make my own career. So this, all of the kind of difficult and restricted childhood gave me more courage than many other kids who actually had love and stay with the parents and never make anything out of this. So this was not changing, but that this I never see my work as a punishment of anything, because I was so much more interesting to research and to look to the ancient cultures, to Tibetans, to Aborigines, to the shamans from the North Brazil, all these people who do rituals, and they do the rituals were incredibly physically heavy. Some of them, in order to become shaman or spiritual man, they even go through rituals who can actually deal with literally the kind of physical dying, you know, at least temporary, and then coming back to life. Like, you know, they will bury them each other, or they will do this other type of ceremonies. And that will really kind of create that interesting gap between real life and consciousness and step them into another state of mind. And this was for me so interesting. So I will always make performances where I push limits as much as I can, never interested of dying. But actually, I had one accident, but this was only one, but nothing really happened, because I always think in performance I'm completely protected, because I go into super self for myself and not in the ordinary small, you know, crime arena, but a really hardcore one. And this was the really idea about how to understand what is behind all this. You know, the Tibetans have the practice for 4 years to live in the dark space and imagine themselves dying, imagine the body rotting and eaten by worms and just corpse in the ground, just in order to actually get rid of fear of dying and get into this other state of mind. So this was my actually reason, that kind of research, much more interesting than kind of self-punishment because I didn't feel alive at home. This is to me like a too small idea. I was always going for the big ideas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. I understand. And it sounds, listening to you now compared to other interviews you've given in past years, I think that after your mother's death, you kind of came across her diaries and you discovered things about her. You understood her better. You realized that she didn't want to spoil you, so she was being harsh for that reason. And I was wondering how you look upon your parents now at your stage in life.
It's so much more understanding. To me, you know, one thing that when you get old, you have this wisdom that you see things in a very different way than as a child, because certain actions, you don't understand what caused them, and then you are deeply hurt. But really, my mother was emotionally so troubled because she really was, my father was love of her life, but he left her for 25 years, a younger woman, so she was really heartbroken. So the one way that she wanted to protect me from all this, you know, the heartbroken, you know, relationships, to be incredibly tough to make me stronger. And she made me stronger. But still also, I really need desperately love from her, which I didn't have. But then when I found the diary and see how much suffering she had, she was writing poetry. She was writing love letter to my father that she never received. And this was like, if I just read one single page of that diary, my entire relationship to her will be very different. And from my father's point of view, this his whole idea of the way how he learned me to swim. He literally threw me in the ocean and just took the with the little boat away and just wait for me to swim there. I was drowning. I was thinking I'm going to die. But the moment I understood that he actually not going to help me, this was the moment that I got so angry. And I say, okay, that means I'm alone and I have to do everything myself. And then I actually swim to the boat. And he knew that I knew to swim, but I was afraid. So he was very brutal way to breaking it, but at the same time made me really strong that I know on the end we all are alone and we all have to take care of ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a moment of transition, I think, in your approach to your parents. I think you're transitioning into much more conciliatory.
It was really something like, wow, this changed. So all of this reason, all this kind of lessons was really hardcore. But at the same time, you know, I mean, like now I am what I am and I will not do anything different.
I mean, that's amazing because, you know, everyone has traumas in childhood and hardships that they wish they didn't have. But to hear you say this now is...
But one thing that I done, all of these traumas, all these childhoods, all these sad stories, I actually make art out of them. And I remember especially the work I made with Bob Wilson called Life and Death of Marina Abramović. I brought to him all his material. And I said, Bob, I want you to redo my life. I give you everything and you restage and make a new mix. Because I always make same mix for myself, but I want you new mix that my life look different to me. And he looked at all the material and we have conversation. He said, you know what? I'm totally not interested in your art. Everybody knows. I'm interested in your tragic stories from your childhood. You're going to play your mother. I said, what? And, you know, it was unbelievable kind of lesson. He said to me, you know, that's what you have to do. And I remember through rehearsal, I cry all the time. Then he stopped and said to me, okay, Marina, stop crying. Public have to cry, not you. Then as after playing this piece and repeating so many theaters, I'm completely free of them. I don't have any of these traumas. I can tell you with loving right now. And then I remember when psychiatrist came, very famous American, to my dressing room. And she said to me, okay, which I just see on the stage, you save yourself 25 years of very expensive therapy.
Absolutely.
Because I share everything. I was free.
Bob Wilson, the great Bob Wilson.
And that was free. I was free.
Absolutely. In a very moving passage of your autobiography, Walk Through Walls, you write that after your father's death, you opened a small valise containing his most prized possessions, and there were photographs, medals, and a small inner pocket contained a little wooden pencil sharpener. And you write, this was the most heart-crushing of everything that I found in this bag. What is life, I thought. It comes and goes like that, and that's it. And what's left? A pencil sharpener. I also personally reflect on how little is left of those who have passed, those who have gone. And I'm surprised, for instance, living in the UK, at how little Queen Elizabeth II is spoken of now, even though she passed only recently and just really was so important to the whole world. And Milan Kundera wrote in his novel Ignorance, the memory retains no more than a millionth, 100 millionth, in short, an infinitesimal bit of the lived life. And can I get you to reflect on human memory, human insignificance, and whether maybe the two are related? Maybe because we have so little memory, we forget our loved ones. I don't know.
You know, I just think that this little wood, it was not even metal sharper. It was a tiny little wooden sharper in the little pocket that survived all these years of his life and why it was so important. And in the end, you know, nothing is important. When we leave, you know, body is mortal. And all what is left is energy who leave the body. And the scientist talking about 21 grams of that energy. And that energy goes who knows where. And then the world continue. And I think it's so important to understand impermanence of human being and to really reflect of this daily, that every day can be last moment of your life. And you have to live every day fully. We always look into past and we always kind of melancholy what happened or future. But we don't live in present. And to all my performances are all about present. This, everything what you see is happening right there in this moment. It's really important. And the temporality of life is so short and so fast. The older you get, the faster life goes.
Yeah, I mean, that's strange, isn't it? Yeah, very strange. There are certain personalities, though, I think extraordinary artistic women who I would describe as divas in the very good, best sense of the word, who continue to be remembered years, even decades after their passing. Maria Callas is one of these people. It's the 100th anniversary of her birth, but we remember her even if it wasn't. We're constantly remembering her. You paid tribute to her in a stage performance at English National Opera recently. And then another one, I think, is the architect Zaha Hadid, who passed away several years ago. But people still talk about her. People still remember her. And I wonder what it is about these extraordinary creative women with extraordinary physical presence who kind of seem to remain with us, seem to dominate the consciousness.
But you know, talking about Callas, it's not physical body of Callas who is important. It's her voice who is immortal. Voice is immortal. Zara Hadid, the sculptures are immortal. I mean, the body comes and goes, but this is what you left behind. And not only what left behind, but also the relation to human beings and how these people carry your work. You know, to me, when I see so much young generation I can, you know, have to love my work, this is the hope that this work is going to be carried by them, not by my generation, who is going to go soon away, but what this generation. This is so important. It's a content work message, what you actually, message have to be universal, message have to be incredibly strong and transcendental. Then the work can live. And, you know, it's in every society, in centuries, there are not too many artists. It may be 2, 3, 4 maximum. And And then this world can live. And the rest is just people who follow. You have originals, and we have the ones who follow. I'm always looking into originals. And originals can be in any category, from scientists, astronauts, writers. You know, it's not actually just art. It's everything. Originals and one who follow.
Yeah, and with your exhibitions at the Royal Academy and also at MoMA in 2010, you have been striving to make sure what you just said, that your art continues, survives you, and that continues to be re-performed well into the future. Some critics, you know, they whinge and whine and they say, oh yeah, well, you know, these re-performances are not the same without Marina. And they're all whinging and whining about that. They say it just doesn't work. But what do you think? I mean, your Royal Academy show seems to have, to me, proven that actually this art can live beyond you.
Of course.
That's a feeling I personally got.
You know how for me it's important to give actually the unconditional permission to artists to perform my work. And I can see that during my own lifetime and not is going to happen when I'm dead anyway. I mean, to me, The House with Ocean View is a good example. It's an extremely difficult performance. You know, the woman is living on the structure for full 12 days without any food or talking or any kind of, devices, total detox of technology. She just drink pure water from the tap on the wall. She can pee publicly, take a shower, and sit on the chair and just literally sleep on the wooden platform. Not easy at all. I made this performance, and now we had in the Royal Academy three people, three different attitudes, three different ways of how to actually interpret this piece. All three incredibly strong, incredibly charismatic, and hardcore working. One is Irish, one is British, and one is Belgium. And this is, I proved that this work can absolutely live without me in generations to come. You know, I always come on the last day to see actually my piece is happening and I'm outside and the piece is there. And that's incredibly important to me. Then also if they change the piece and change different structures, I have to absolutely take it because this is their interpretation, not mine. And that's really, really good training for me.
Yeah, and for them. I mean, you've trained those people. They don't just show up.
And with my own, also, you have to see your own limits physically. You know, if you're 77, I could not do the performance when I was 20. But artist is present. I done with 65, which was impossible to do when I'm 20 because I didn't had the stamina, wisdom, or willpower to do this. So it depends. Every age, he have his own, beauty and limits.
Absolutely. Earlier this year, you had, unfortunately, as you said, an extremely serious health scare, and it was thankfully overcome. And you say that you think about death every day, and I wondered, what does death evoke in your mind?
No, it's just, it's wonderful to wake up in the morning and really be happy to start with. I always start with happiness. I'm always in good mood. I start with the tea and then just thinking, okay, what's this going to be today? I have a very positive attitude to life. And then, even time is not always, everything great and bright. Sometimes they have terrible messages. This happened, that happened. I'm always thinking how to learn from everything, something, and to really fully live the day, really fully.
The Guardian art critic Adrian Searle recently wrote, "The best of Marina's art is not over yet." And you mentioned briefly that you were doing some exploration of Balkan eroticism. I think, can you talk a little bit about this next project?
I don't like much to talk about next project
sure.
Because I'm always thinking it's jinxing. But basically, I'm doing something which is going to premiere in Manchester Festival in October in the new space in 2025. I need 2 years to make this work. And I'm really exploring the Balkan, Bulgaria, Hungary, Albania, Greece, Turkey, my own Serbian culture, and looking for the rituals who are very erotic, connected to the, ancient times and to bring them new light today. Because we call everything which is erotic, we call immediately pornography. It's a big division between these two. I want to find poetry. I want to find this connection that really our ancient, the parents knew about it. You know, like how to save the cabbage, you know, cabbage to save the cabbage is to take a worm and tie it on the little string on the penis of young child, and then hold the child above the cabbage field, and then the cabbage will not eat by anything. So this is insane when you think as an image, but at the same time, it's 14th century ritual. So these kind of rituals are incredible, and there are so many interesting that we can learn from. And I want to revisit the, you know, ancient style, forgotten language, and bring it to us today.
Yeah, thank you. Marina, this is my last question to you. I read your autobiography, and I've listened to many, many podcast interviews with you. And in one part, somewhere, you recall that once, you know, when you were, I think, living in Amsterdam, in the Netherlands, you kind of swapped roles with a prostitute. And it was kind of like a failed experiment for you and for her. And I just wondered if, as a parting anecdote, you could tell us this story so we could have a little laugh about this.
Oh, that's a funny story. Basically, you know, the first time I was invited outside of my country to do performance was in Amsterdam in the Gallery of the Apple, who was the only gallery who was dealing with performance at the time. We are talking 74, 75. And I remember that, you know, first I come from such a strict upbringing. So I come to Amsterdam in the time of Provost, in the time of the, you know, of the drugs revolution. You know, I was looking, I could not believe that it's all freedom there coming from Belgrade. And then I went to the red light district and I see all the prostitutes there. It was like shocking for me. So the one thing that, you know, in that time we rebel, especially with my mother education, I was thinking, okay, something that I'm the most afraid to do is to change the role with prostitute. That actually she comes to be me in the gallery and I become her in her location. And it took 3 months to find really prostitute because nobody wanted to do it. Finally, I found the pimp she said, okay, my wife is going to do, who also was working the window. So we said, okay, and I want to do 6 hours that she's opening on my show and I'm sitting in the window. And then at that time, you know, art is not great pay. But anyway, so she said, I like you, I give you 3 hours. So I'm sitting in her window, she's sitting in the gallery. And this was horrifying experience because, you know, in my education, prostitute is the lowest you can get. So can you imagine put yourself as an artist with a huge, you know, ego to be actually nobody? So she never told me anything what I should do, and I never told her what she do in the gallery. But we have two cameras, one normal camera in the gallery and one secret her window. And we put this after the event, we put these two cameras together to see the result. And she said to me, okay, you will starve to death because you have no talent to be prostitute any kind. You know, so what happened is only the instructions she gave to me that she has a certain price and nobody should go below this price. So we are talking about 3 hours. I'm sitting in the window and I'm terrified. And I'm sitting completely motionless, looking one point. And there only came two people. One totally drunk, we didn't care. And another one, you know, asked for her. And that's it. Drunk didn't want to pay the price. The drunk only asked for her. So that was my experience. Her experience, people come around to her and say, how you feel? She feel I'm very hot. And she started taking clothes off. Then she said, what do you think about art? She said, I know everything about sex, but nothing about art. And this was so kind of natural, her experience, and mine was so, you know, I was really facing my biggest fear. And this was the peace exchange, the role. She was 12 years professional prostitute. I was 12 years professional artist.
What a fantastic way to end this conversation, Marina Abramović. It's really been a true privilege speaking to you, and thank you again so much for accepting my invitation to be a star guest of Culture Blast. And I wish you nothing but the best in all of your future endeavors.
I'm sure that we'll see each other again.
I'm absolutely sure of it too. Thank you so much, Marina.
Thank you.
It's been lovely talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
My thanks go to Marina Abramović for being our star guest as we relaunch the Culture Blast podcast and bring to you a brand new series of interviews with major personalities from the world of culture. Make sure and subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast platform so you never miss an episode. And share it far and wide with everybody you know so they can listen too. My interview with Marina would not have been possible without the support of the curator Joseph O'Connor, founder and artistic director of Circa Art. And Culture Blast as a program would simply not exist without the great Karina Pierre-Rochard, co-founder and executive producer. Nor would the program be of the caliber that it is without the exceptional talents of our sound producer, Ben Eshmaid. And allow me to doff my hat to our very talented soundtrack composer, Oliver Scherer, C-H-E-R-E-R, whose music you can find on Spotify and every other platform. As for me, I look forward to bringing you another great guest in the very near future. Thank you so much for tuning in.